Hello and happy Father's Day to all who celebrate. It's Cory Doctorow and this is the Cory Doctorow Podcast. Here's where you can catch me in the coming weeks. I have three gigs coming up this week. On June the 20th, I'll be here in Los Angeles on stage recording the Go Fact Yourself podcast. On June the 21st, you can catch me online doing a virtual reading for the Locus Awards. And then on the 22nd, I'm traveling to Oakland, California. I'm going to do the keynote for the Locus Awards, and I'm also going to be on a panel that day. On the 14th of July, you'll catch me in New York, in Queens, at Hackers on Planet Earth, the 15th edition. And then on July the 20th and 21st in Chicago, I'll be doing a bookstore talk in the Loop, and then doing a keynote for the American Association of Law Libraries conference. So yeah, it's Father's Day. I had a great Father's Day. My wife woke me up with breakfast in bed. Normally my kid would be along too, but she's a teenager this summer. She's got her driver's license. She's staying out late and she slept in. So it was just my wife, but I got the Father's Day song from Groucho Marx. You know, the one that goes, "Today, Father is Father's Day and we're giving you a tie." I got two choruses of it, which was great, and a great card. And then my kid got up and gave me a great card as well with a hand-drawn picture of David Byrne in the big suit. Evidently, our trip to see Stop Making Sense at the Pantages with all of the talking heads in attendance was good for her and made an impression. And tonight, we are going out to see a comedy show, and we're going out for drinks, and what else? Someone else is taking out the garbage bins, someone else is doing the laundry, all of my regular chores are in someone else's hands today. So yeah, it's a pretty good Father's Day for me. And also, this morning, I had the lovely experience of downloading the latest Cool Zone Media podcast, where Robert Evans and Magpie Killjoy have been doing a serialized podcast reading and discussion of my story, Party Discipline, which is a walkaway story. They've been doing such a great job. Tune into it. See what you think. It's part two of three. So if you get the first two parts this week, you can finish it up at the end of the week. And that'll be nice for you and me as well. Okay, so this week's podcast is a little bit of a departure. As you may know, I have this newsletter, pluralistic.net, and every day I go through my old blog posts and do a little roundup of headlines and links from 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and 1 year ago today. And it was while I was doing that roundup and getting it ready for tomorrow, as I record this, it's the 16th of June, so I was getting the 17th of June's stuff in the chute, I saw that it had been 20 years to the day since I traveled to Seattle and then took a rental car out to Redmond and went to Microsoft Research and gave an invited talk on digital rights management and why digital rights management was a bad deal for Microsoft, and then went back to my hotel room and published the transcript. And it went early blog viral. Other people did their own readings of it. Jason Kotke uploaded a reading of it. People reformatted it. It got turned into a wiki version with annotations by Quinn Norton. It got turned into a beautiful laid out printed PDF from the Change This blog. Anil Dash and Matt Howey formatted it for HTML. Trevor Smith made a purple version so you could link to individual paragraphs. There was machine-generated cut-ups. There was a Pig Latin version. There was translations into Danish, French, Finnish, German, Hebrew, Hungarian, Italian, Japanese, Norwegian, Polish, Portuguese, Brazilian, Portuguese, European, Spanish, and Swedish, all by different readers in the days that came afterwards. And I put a public domain dedication on it, and people shared it around. I didn't know this speech was going to do as well as it had. I had not planned on that. It was just one of many speeches I had given on this subject. That was why I got invited to go speak at Microsoft about it. But it really did the numbers, and it kind of tells you how reaching some kind of tipping point or breaking out, or what sociologists would call breaching, is rarely the effect of someone doing something once and having it catch on, but rather it's like the reflection of accumulated momentum reaching some kind of phase change. And I've had that happen several times since with enshittification and adversarial interoperability and lots of other subjects. They're really all the same kind of subject, but it's, you know, relating to more people's lives because the consequences of this stuff have gone from largely hypothetical to extremely live and present in people's lives. And so it's becoming, I think, more frequent and on a larger scale, which is really interesting to contemplate. I'm trying to remember who invited me to Microsoft Research. I think it was Mark Smith, who did a lot of early research on social graph analysis using Usenet posts. I remember around then he traveled to San Francisco, where I was living in the Mission, and we went out for big greasy omelets at the place that I used to go to for breakfast, and he told me about his research. And I think that's who invited me, but I wouldn't swear to it. It might have been Peter Biddle from the Palladium team who's working on trusted computing. But anyways, it was actually really well received by the research crowd. Microsoft Research has always been the cool end of Microsoft. And, you know, those of you who are reading my newsletter know that I wrote quite a scorching Jeremiah about Microsoft this week. I stand by every word. And actually, I've always thought of Microsoft Research and some of the other people I've met at Microsoft too, including in the security department, ironically enough, as an example of how a sick institution can take people who are good and do good work and want to do good and accumulate all of that work and do something terrible with it. And I think that it shows you how important institutions are. I know Ronald Coase is often associated rightly with neoliberalism in the Chicago School, but Ronald Coase's ideas about why institutions exist, I think, have been very important to how I conceive of the world. And also, I think Ronald Coase's ideas about institutions imply that the character of institutions matters a lot. And it's an area where I'm a little conflicted, because I don't want to say that there's like good companies and bad companies. I think companies respond to incentives. But I think there are good cultures and bad cultures. And that a bad culture combined with bad incentives makes a bad company. And maybe a bad culture with good incentives can make a company that is at the very least not harmful and sometimes good. And I think to the extent that Microsoft turns out things that are good, you know, their gaming division has done some quite cool games and so on. They've made some pretty cool hardware. I think that it's the triumph of the constraints imposed by society on the sickness of a culture founded by people who I think are sociopaths. And I don't use that word hyperbolically. I think Bill Gates is a sociopath. And also that created a management culture where in order to thrive and rise through the ranks and become a decision maker, you really need to also be a sociopath. You need to be impedance matched with the kind of Machiavelli LARPers who founded Microsoft and defined it. Anyway, that's a lot of words. So anyway, I noticed that it had been 20 years since this momentous occasion, and I thought, what the fuck? I'll read my Microsoft DRM speech. Now, I'm coming into this cold. I did not reread it. I have not read it in at least 10 years, probably more like 15. And so you and I are both going to find out what was in this talk 20 years ago that went early blog viral. All right, then. Without further ado, from June 17th, 2004, here is my Microsoft Research DRM talk. Greetings, fellow pirates. Arr! I'm here to talk to you today about copyright, technology, and DRM. I work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation on copyright stuff, mostly, and I live in London. Oh God, I was living in London then. I forgot that somehow. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a kind of mouthpiece activist type, though occasionally they shave me and stuff me into my bar mitzvah suit and send me to a standards body or to the UN to stir up trouble. I spend about 3 weeks a month on the road doing completely weird stuff like going to Microsoft to talk about DRM. I lead a double life. I'm also a science fiction writer. That means I've got a dog in this fight because I've been dreaming of making my living from writing since I was 12 years old. Admittedly, my IP-based biz isn't as big as yours, but I guarantee you that it's every bit as important to me as yours is to you. Here's what I'm here to convince you of. 1. That DRM systems don't work. 2. That DRM systems are bad for society. 3. That DRM systems are bad for business. 4. That DRM systems are bad for artists. And 5. That DRM is a bad business move for Microsoft. It's a big brief, this talk. Microsoft has sunk a lot of capital into DRM systems and spent a lot of time sending folks like Martha and Brian and Peter around to various smoke-filled rooms to make sure that Microsoft DRM finds a hospitable home in the future world. Companies like Microsoft steer like old Buicks, and this issue has a lot of forward momentum that will be hard to soak up without driving the engine block back into the driver's compartment. At best, I think that Microsoft might convert some of that momentum on DRM into Angular momentum, and in so doing, save all our asses. Let's dive into it. 1. DRM systems don't work. This breaks down into two parts. 1. A quick refresher course in crypto theory. And 2. Applying that to DRM. Cryptography, secret writing, is the practice of keeping secrets. It involves three parties: a sender, a receiver, and an attacker. Actually, there can be more attackers, senders, and recipients, but let's keep this simple. We usually call these people Alice, Bob, and Carol. Let's say we're in the days of the Caesar, the Gallic War. You need to send messages back and forth to your generals, and you'd prefer that the enemy doesn't get hold of them. You can rely on the idea that anyone who intercepts your message is probably illiterate, but that's a tough bet to stake your empire on. You can put your messages into the hands of reliable messengers who will chew them up and swallow them if captured, but that doesn't help you if Brad Pitt and his men in skirts skewer him with an arrow before he knows what's hit him. So, you encipher your message with something like Rot 13, where every character is rotated halfway through the alphabet. They used to do this with non-worksafe material on Usenet, back when anyone on Usenet cared about worksafeness. A would become N, B is O, C is P, and so forth. To decipher, you just add 13 more, so N goes to A, O to B, yada yada. Well, this is pretty lame. As soon as anyone figures out your algorithm, your secret is gonzoed. So, if you're Caesar, you spend a lot of time worrying about keeping the existence of your messengers and their payloads secret. Get that? You're Augustus, and you need to send a message to Brad without Cassius, a word I'm reliably informed means cheese-like or pertaining to cheese, getting his hands on it. You give the message to Diotimacius, the fleetest runner in the Empire, and you encipher it with Rot 13 and send him out of the garrison in the pitchest hour of the night, making sure no one knows that you've sent it out. Cassius has spies everywhere, in the garrison and staked out on the road, and if one of them puts an arrow through Diotimacius, they'll have their hands on the message, and if they figure out the cipher, you're borked. So the existence of the message is a secret. The cipher is a secret. The cipher text is a secret. That's a lot of secrets, and the more secrets you got, the less secure you are, especially if any of those secrets are shared. Shared secrets aren't really that secret any longer. Time passes, stuff happens, and then Tesla invents the radio and Marconi takes credit for it. This is both good news and bad news for crypto. On the one hand, your messages can get to anywhere with a receiver and an antenna, which is great for the brave fifth colonists working behind enemy lines. On the other hand, anyone with an antenna can listen in on the message, which means that it's no longer practical to keep the existence of the message a secret. Anytime Adolf sends a message to Berlin, he can assume Churchill overhears it, which is okay, because now we have computers. Big, bulky, primitive mechanical computers, but computers still. Computers are machines for rearranging numbers, and so scientists on both sides engage in a fiendish competition to invent the most cleverest method they can for rearranging numerically represented text so that the other side can't unscramble it. The existence of the message isn't a secret anymore, but the cipher is. But this is still too many secrets. If Bobby intercepts one of Adolf's Enigma machines, he can give Churchill all kinds of intelligence. I mean, this was good news for Churchill and us, but bad news for Adolf. And at the end of the day, it's bad news for anyone who wants to keep a secret. Enter keys. A cipher that uses a key is still more secure. Even if the cipher is disclosed, even if the cipher text is intercepted, without the key, or a break, the message is secret. Post-war, this is doubly important as we begin to realize what I think of as Schneier's Law. Any person can invent a security system so clever that she or he can't think of how to break it. This means that the only experimental methodology for discovering if you've made mistakes in your cipher is to tell all the smart people you can about it and ask them to think of ways to break it. Without this critical step, you'll eventually end up living in a fool's paradise, where your attacker has broken your cipher ages ago and is quietly decrypting all her intercepts of your messages, snickering at you. Best of all, there's only one secret, the key. And with dual key crypto, it becomes a lot easier for Alice and Bob to keep their keys secret from Carol, even if they've never met. So long as Alice and Bob can keep their keys secret, they can assume that Carol won't gain access to their clear text messages, even though she has access to the cipher and the ciphertext. Conveniently enough, the keys are the shortest and simplest of the secrets, too. Hence, even easier to keep away from Carol. Hooray for Bob and Alice! Now, let's apply this to DRM. In DRM, the attacker is also the recipient. It's not Alice and Bob and Carol, it's just Alice and Bob. Alice sells Bob a DVD. She sells Bob a DVD player. The DVD has a movie on it, say Pirates of the Caribbean, and it's enciphered with an algorithm called CSS, the Content Scrambling System. The DVD player has a CSS unscrambler. Now, let's take stock of what's a secret here. The cipher is well known. The ciphertext is most assuredly in enemy hands. Arr. So what? As long as the key is secret from the attacker, we're golden. But here's the rub. Alice wants Bob to buy Pirates of the Caribbean from her. Bob will only buy Pirates of the Caribbean if he can descramble the CSS encrypted VOB, the video object, on his DVD player. Otherwise, the disc is only useful to Bob as a drinks coaster. So Alice has to provide Bob, the attacker, with the key, the cipher, and the ciphertext. Hilarity ensues. DRM systems are usually broken in minutes, sometimes days, rarely months. It's not because the people who think them up are stupid. It's not because the people who break them are smart. It's not because there is a flaw in the algorithms. At the end of the day, all DRM systems share a common vulnerability. They provide their attackers with ciphertext, the cipher, and the key. At this point, the secret isn't a secret anymore. Part 2. DRM systems are bad for society. Raise your hand if you're thinking something like, but DRM doesn't have to be proof against smart attackers, only average individuals. It's like a speed bump. Put your hand down. This is a fallacy for two reasons, one technical and one social. They're both bad for society, though. Here's the technical reason. I don't need to be a cracker to break your DRM. I only need to know how to search Google or Kazaa or any of the other general purpose search tools for the clear text that someone smarter than me has extracted. Raise your hand if you're thinking something like, but NGSCB, a little author's notes here, that's Next Generation Secure Computing Base that later became called Palladium, that later became called Trusted Computing, and that these days trades under names like Secure Enclaves. Anyway, back to the text. But NGSCB can solve this problem. We'll lock up the secrets on the logic board and goop it all up with epoxy. Put your hand down. Raise your hand if you're the co-author of the Darknet paper. Little author's note here, Peter Biddle, who helped invent Palladium, coined the term Darknet in a paper called The Darknet, where he basically predicted that people would start using Tor to communicate and send each other stuff that trusted computing stopped them from transmitting on the regular internet. Peter's a very smart guy. Raise your hand if you're a co-author of the Darknet paper. Everyone in the first group? Meet the co-authors of the Darknet paper. This is a paper that says, among other things, that DRM will fail for this very reason. Put your hands down, guys. Here is the social reason that DRM fails. Keeping an honest user honest is like keeping a tall user tall. DRM vendors tell us that their technology is meant to be proof against average users, not organized criminals like the Ukrainian pirates who stamp out millions of high-quality counterfeits. It's not meant to be proof against sophisticated college kids. It's not meant to be proof against anyone who knows how to edit her registry, or hold down the shift key at the right moment, or use a search engine. At the end of the day, the user DRM is meant to defend against is the most sophisticated and least capable among us. Here is a true story about a user I know who was stopped by DRM. She's smart, college educated, and knows nothing about electronics. She has three kids. She has a DVD in the living room and an old VHS deck in the kids' playroom. One day, she brought home the Toy Story DVD for the kids. That's a substantial investment, and given the generally jam-smeared character of everything that kids get their paws on, she decided to tape the DVD off the VHS and give that to the kids. That way she could make a fresh VHS copy when the first one went south. She cabled her DVD into her VHS and pressed play on the DVD and record on the VCR and waited. Before I go farther, I want us all to stop a moment and marvel at this. Here is someone who is practically technophobic, but who was able to construct a mental model of sufficient accuracy that she figured out that she could connect her cables in the right order and dub her digital disc off to analog tape. I imagine everyone in this room is the frontline tech support for someone in her or his family. Wouldn't it be great if all our non-geek friends and relatives were this clever and imaginative? I also want to point out that this is the proverbial honest user. She's not making a copy for the next door neighbors. She's not making a copy and selling it on a blanket on Canal Street. She's not ripping it to her hard drive, DivX encoding it, and putting it in her Kazaa SharePoint. She's doing something honest, moving it from one format to another. She's home taping. Except she fails. There's a DRM system called MacroVision, embedded by law in every VHS, that messes with the vertical blanking interval in the signal and causes any tape made in this fashion to fail. MacroVision can be defeated for about $10, with a gadget readily available on eBay. But our infringer doesn't know that. She's honest, technically unsophisticated. Not stupid, mind you, just naive. The Darknet paper addresses this possibility. It even predicts what this person will do in the long run. She'll find out about Kazaa, and the next time she wants to get a movie for the kids, she'll download it from the net and burn it for them. In order to delay that day as long as possible, our lawmakers and big rights holder interests have come up with a disastrous policy called anti-circumvention. Here's how anti-circumvention works. If you put a lock, an access control, around a copyrighted work, it is illegal to break that lock. It is illegal to make a tool that breaks that lock. It's illegal to tell someone how to make that tool. One court even held it illegal to tell someone where she can find out how to make that tool. Remember Schneier's law? Anyone can come up with a security system so clever that he can't see its flaws. The only way to find the flaws in security is to disclose the system's workings and invite public feedback. But now, we live in a world where any cipher used to fence off a copyrighted work is off limits to that kind of feedback. That's something that a Princeton engineering prof named Ed Felton and his team discovered when he submitted a paper to an academic conference on the failings in the Secure Digital Music Initiative, a watermarking scheme proposed by the record industry. The RIAA responded by threatening to sue his ass if he tried. We fought them, because Ed is the kind of client that impact litigators love. Unimpeachable and clean cut, and the RIAA folded. Lucky Ed. Maybe the next guy isn't so lucky. Matter of fact, the next guy wasn't. Dmitry Skilyarov is a Russian programmer who gave a talk at a HackerCon in Vegas on the failings in Adobe's ebook locks. The FBI threw him in the slam for 30 days. He copped a plea, went home to Russia, and the Russian equivalent of the State Department issued a blanket warning to his researchers to stay away from American conferences since we'd apparently turned into the kind of country where certain equations are illegal. And the Russian equivalent of the State Department issued a blanket warning to its researchers to stay away from American conferences, since we'd apparently turned into the kind of country where certain equations are illegal. Anti-circumvention is a powerful tool for people who want to exclude competitors. If you claim that your car engine firmware is a copyrighted work, you can sue anyone who makes a tool for interfacing with it. that's not just bad news for mechanics. Think of the hot rodders who want to chip their cars to tweak the performance settings. We have companies like Lexmark claiming that their printer cartridges contain copyrighted works, software that trips an I am empty flag when the toner runs out, and have sued a competitor who made a remanufactured cartridge that reset that flag. Even garage door opener companies have gotten in on the act, claiming that their receivers' firmware are copyrighted works. Copyrighted cars, print cartridges, and garage door openers? What's next? Copyrighted light fixtures? Another author's note here, yeah, that's exactly what Philips did with their Hue light bulbs. God damn it. Oh, this was a warning, not a suggestion. Shit. Even in the context of legitimate, traditional, copyrighted works like movies on DVDs, anti-circumvention is bad news. Copyright is a delicate balance. It gives creators and their assignees some rights, but it also reserves some rights to the public. For example, an author has no right to prohibit anyone from transcoding his books into assistive formats for the blind. More importantly, though, a creator has a very limited say over what you can do once you lawfully acquire her works. If I buy your book, your painting, or your DVD, it belongs to me. It's my property, not intellectual property, a wacky kind of pseudo-property, but real, no-fooling, actual, tangible property. The kind of thing that courts have been managing through property law for centuries. But anti-circumvention lets rights holders invent new and exciting copyrights for themselves, to write private laws without accountability or deliberation that expropriate your interest in your physical property to their favors. Region-coded DVDs are an example of this. There's no copyright here or in anywhere I know of that says that an author should be able to control where you enjoy her creative works once you've paid for them. I can buy a book and throw it in my bag and take it anywhere from Toronto to Timbuktu and read it wherever I am. I can even buy books in America and bring them to the UK, where the author may have an exclusive distribution deal with a local publisher who sells them for double the US shelf price. When I'm done with it, I can sell it on or give it away in the UK. Copyright lawyers call this first sale, but it may be simpler to think of it as capitalism. The keys to decrypt a DVD are controlled by an org called the DVD-CCA, and they have a bunch of licensing requirements for anyone who gets a key from them. Among these is something called region coding. If you buy a DVD in France, it'll have a flag set that says, "I'm a European DVD." Bring that DVD to America, and your DVD player will compare the flag to its list of permitted regions, and if they don't match, it will tell you that it's not allowed to play your disc. Remember, there is no copyright that says that an author gets to do this. When we wrote the copyright statutes and granted authors the right to control display, performance, duplication, derivative works, and so forth, we didn't leave out geography by accident. That was on purpose. So when your French DVD won't play in America, that's not because it'd be illegal to do so. It's because the studios have invented a business model and then invented a copyright law to prop it up. The DVD is your property, and so is the DVD player. But if you break the region coding on your disc, you're going to run afoul of anti-circumvention. That's what happened to Jan Johansson, a Norwegian teenager who wanted to watch French DVDs on his Norwegian DVD player. He and some pals wrote some code to break the CSS so he could do so. He's a wanted man here in America. In Norway, the studios put the local fuzz up to bring him up on charges of unlawfully trespassing upon a computer system. When his defense asked, "Which computer has Jan trespassed upon?" the answer was, his own. His, no fooling, real and physical property has been expropriated by the weird, notional, metaphorical intellectual property on his DVD. DRM only works if your record player becomes the property of whomever's records you're playing. 3. DRM systems are bad for business. This is the worst of all the ideas embodied by DRM, that people who make record players should be able to spec whose records you can listen to, and that people who make records should have a veto over the design of record players. We've never had that principle. In fact, we've always had just the reverse. Think about all the things that can be plugged into a parallel or serial interface, which were never envisioned by their inventors. Our strong economy and rapid innovation are byproducts of the ability of anyone to make anything that plugs into anything else. From the Flowbee electric razor that snaps onto the end of your vacuum hose to the octopus spilling out of your car's dashboard lighter socket, standard interfaces that anyone can build are what makes billionaires out of nerds. The courts affirm this again and again. It used to be illegal to plug anything that didn't come from AT&T into your phone jack. They claim that this was for the safety of the network, but really it was about propping up this little penny-ante racket that AT&T had and charging you a rental fee for your phone until you paid for it 1,000 times over. When the ban was struck down, it created the market for third-party phone equipment, from talking novelty phones to answering machines to cordless handsets to headsets, billions of dollars in economic activity that had been suppressed by the closed interface. Note that AT&T was one of the big beneficiaries on this. They also got into the business of making PhoneKit. DRM is the software equivalent of those closed hardware interfaces. Robert Scoble is a softie who has an excellent blog where he wrote an essay about the best way to protect your investment in the digital music you buy. Should you buy Apple iTunes Music or Microsoft DRM Music? Scoble argued that Microsoft's music was a sounder investment because Microsoft would have more downstream licensees for its proprietary format, and therefore you'd have a richer ecosystem of devices to choose from when you were shopping for gizmos to play your virtual records on. Another author's note here. Well, Scoble basically was doing this from the start, I guess. When someone tells you who you are, listen to them. What a weird idea that we should evaluate our record purchases on the basis of which recording company will allow the greatest diversity of record players to play its discs. That's like telling someone to buy Betamax instead of the Edison kinetoscope because Thomas Edison is a crank about licensing his patents. All the while, ignoring the world's relentless march to the more open VHS format. It's a bad business. DVD is a format where the guy who makes the records gets to design the record players. Ask yourself, how much innovation has there been over the past decade of DVD players? They've gotten cheaper and smaller, but where are the weird and amazing new markets for DVD that were opened up by the VCR? There's a company that's manufacturing the world's first HDD-based DVD jukebox, a thing that holds 100 movies, and they're charging $27,000 for this thing. We're talking about a few thousand dollars worth of components. All that other cost is the cost of anti-competition. 4. DVD systems are bad for artists. But what of the artist? The hardworking filmmaker, the ink-stained scribbler, the heroin-cured leathery rock star. We poor slobs of the creative class are everyone's favorite poster children here. The RIAA and MPAA hold us up and say, "Won't someone please think of the children?" File sharers say, "Yeah, we're thinking about the artist, but the labels are the man. Who cares what happens to you?" To understand what DRM does to artists, you need to understand how technology and copyright interact. Copyright is inherently technological, since the things it addresses, copyright, transmitting, and so on, are inherently technological. The piano roll was the first system for cheaply copying music. It was invented at a time when the dominant form of entertainment in America was getting a talented pianist to come into your living room and pound out some tunes while you sang along. The music industry consisted mostly of sheet music publishers. The player piano was a digital recording and playback system. Piano roll companies bought sheet music and ripped the notes printed on it into zeros and ones on a long roll of computer tape, which they sold by the thousands, the hundreds of thousands, the millions. They did this without a penny's compensation to the publishers. They were digital music pirates. Arrrr! Predictably, the composers and music publishers went nutso. John Philip Sousa showed up in Congress to say, "These talking machines are going to ruin the artistic development of music in this country. When I was a boy, in front of every house in the summer evenings, you would find young people together singing the songs of the day or old songs. Today, you hear these infernal machines going day and night. We will not have a vocal cord left. The vocal cord will be eliminated by a process of evolution, as was the tale of man when he came from the ape. The publishers asked Congress to ban the piano roll and to create a law that said that any new system for reproducing music should be subject to a veto from their industry association. Lucky for us, Congress realized what side of their bread had butter on it and decided not to criminalize the dominant form of entertainment in America. But there was the problem of paying artists. The Constitution sets out the purpose of American copyright: to promote the useful arts and sciences. The composers had a credible story that they'd do less composing if they weren't paid for it, so Congress needed a fix. Here's what they came up with. Anyone who paid a music publisher 2 cents would have the right to make one piano roll of any song that publisher published. The publisher couldn't say no, and no one had to hire a lawyer at $200 an hour to argue about whether the payment should be 2 cents or a nickel. This compulsory license is still in place today. When Joe Cocker sings "With a Little Help from My Friends," he pays a fixed fee to the Beatles publisher, and away he goes, even if Ringo hates the idea. If you ever wondered how Sid Vicious talked Paul Anka into letting him get a crack at "My Way," well, now you know. The compulsory license created a world where 1,000 times more money was made by 1,000 times more creators who made 1,000 times more music that reached 1,000 times more people. This story repeats itself throughout the technological century, every 10 or 15 years. Radio was enabled by a voluntary blanket license. The music companies got together and asked for a consent decree so they could offer all their music for a flat fee. Cable TV took a compulsory. The only way cable operators could get their hands on broadcasts was to pirate them and shove them down the wire. And Congress saw fit to legalize this practice rather than screw around with their constituents' TVs. Sometimes the courts and Congress decided to simply take away a copyright. That's what happened with the VCR. When Sony brought out the VCR in 1976, the studios had already decided what the experience of watching a movie in your living room would look like. They'd licensed out their programming for use on a machine called a DiscoVision, which played big LP-sized discs that were read-only. It was proto-DRM. The copyright scholars of the day didn't give the VCR very good odds. Sony argued that their box allowed for a fair use, which is defined as a use that the court rules as a defense against infringement based on 4 factors. Whether the use transforms the work into something new, like a collage, whether it uses all or some of the work, whether the work is artistic or mainly factual, and whether the use undercuts the creator's business model. The Betamax failed on all 4 fronts. When you time-shifted or duplicated a Hollywood movie off the air, you made a non-transformative use of 100% of a creative work in a way that directly undercut the DiscoVision licensing system. Jack Valenti, the mouthpiece for the motion picture industry, told Congress in 1982 that the VCR was to the American film industry as the Boston Strangler is to a woman home alone. But the Supreme Court ruled against Hollywood in 1984 when it determined that any device capable of a substantial, non-infringing use was legal. In other words, we don't buy this Boston Strangler business. If your business model can't survive the emergence of this general-purpose tool, it's time to get another business model or go broke. And Hollywood found another business model, as the broadcasters had, as the vaudeville artists had, as the music publishers had. And they made more art that paid more artists and reached a wider audience. There's one thing that every new art business model had in common. It embraced the medium it lived in. This is the overweening characteristic of every single successful new medium. It is true to itself. The Luther Bible didn't succeed on the axes that made a hand-copied monk Bible valuable. They were ugly. They weren't in church Latin, and they weren't read aloud by someone who could interpret it for his lay audience. They didn't represent years of devoted, with a capital D, labor by someone who had given his life over to God. the thing that made the Luther Bible a success was its scalability. It was more popular because it was more proliferate. All success factors for a new medium pale beside its profligacy. The most successful organisms on Earth are those that reproduce the most. Bugs and bacteria, nematodes and viri. Reproduction is the best of all survival strategies. Piano rolls didn't sound as good as the music of a skilled pianist, but they scaled better. Radio lacked the social elements of live performance, but more people could build a crystal set and get it aimed correctly than could pack into even the largest vaudeville house. MP3s don't come with liner notes. They aren't sold to you by a hipper-than-thou record store clerk who can help you make your choice. Bad rips and truncated files abound. I once downloaded a 12-second copy of Hey Jude from the original Napster. Yet MP3 is outcompeting the CD. I don't know what to do with CDs anymore. I get them, and they're like the especially nice garment bag they give you at the fancy suit shop. It's nice, and you feel like a goof for throwing it out, but Christ, how many of these things can you usefully own? I can put 10,000 songs on my laptop, but a comparable pile of discs with liner notes and so forth, that's a liability. It's a piece of my monthly storage locker costs. Here are the two most important things to know about computers and the internet. 1. A computer is a machine for rearranging bits. And 2. The internet is a machine for moving bits from one place to another very cheaply and quickly. Any new medium that takes hold on the internet and with computers will embrace these two facts, not regret them. A newspaper press is a machine for spitting out cheap and smeary newsprint at speed. If you try to make it output fine art lithos, you'll get junk. If you try to make it output newspapers, you'll get the basis for a free society. And so it is with the internet. At the heyday of Napster, record execs used to show up at conference and tell everyone that Napster was doomed because no one wanted lossily compressed MP3s with no liner notes and truncated files and misspelled metadata. Today, we hear ebook publishers tell each other, and anyone who'll listen, that the barrier to ebooks is screen resolution. It's bollocks, and so is the whole sermonette about how nice a book looks on your bookcase, or how nice it smells, and how easy it is to slip into the tub. These are obvious and untrue things, like the idea that radio will catch on once they figure out how to sell you hot dogs during the intermission, or that movies will really hit their stride when we can figure out how to bring the actors out for an encore when the films run out, or that what the Protestant Reformation really needs is Luther Bibles with facsimile illumination in the margin and a rent-a-priest to read aloud from your personal Word of God. New media don't succeed because they're like the old media, only better. They succeed because they're worse than the old media at the stuff the old media is good at, and better at the stuff that the old media is bad at. Books are good at being paperwhite, high resolution, low infrastructure, cheap, and disposable. Ebooks are good at being everywhere in the world at the same time for free in a form that is so malleable that you can just paste bomb it into your IM session or turn it into a page a day mailing list. The only really successful e-publishing, I mean hundreds of thousands, millions of copies distributed and read, is the bookwares scene, where scanned and OCR'd books are distributed on the darknet. The only legit publishers with success at e-publishing are the ones whose books cross the internet without technological fetter. Publishers like Bain Books and my own, Tor, who are making some or all of their catalogs available in ASCII and HTML and PDF. The hardware-dependent ebooks, the DRM use and copy-restricted ebooks, they're cratering. Sales measured in tens, sometimes the hundreds. Science fiction is a niche business, but when you're selling copies by the 10, it's not even a business, it's a hobby. Every one of you has been riding a curve where you read more and more words off of more and more screens every day through most of your professional careers. It's zero sum. You've also been reading fewer words off fewer pages as time went by. The dinosauric executive who prints his email and dictates a reply to his secretary is info roadkill. Today, at this very second, people read words off of screens for every hour that they can find. Your kids stare at their Game Boys until their eyes fall out. Euroteens ring doorbells with their hypertrophied SMS-twitching thumbs instead of their index fingers. paper books are the packaging that books come in. Cheap printer binderies like the Internet Bookmobile that can produce a full bleed, four color glossy cover, printed spine, perfect bound book in 10 minutes for a dollar are the future of paper books. When you need an instance of a paper book, you'll generate one or part of one and pitch it out when you're done. I landed at SeaTac on Monday and burned a couple of CDs from my music collection to listen to in the rental car. When I drop the car off, I'll leave them behind. Who needs them? Whenever a new technology has disrupted copyright, we've changed copyright. Copyright isn't an ethical proposition, it's a utilitarian one. There's nothing moral about paying a composer tuppence for the piano roll rights. There's nothing immoral about not paying Hollywood for the right to videotape a movie off your TV. They're just the best way of balancing out, so that people's physical property rights in their VCRs and phonographs are respected, and so that creators get enough of a dangling carrot to go on making shows and music and books and paintings. Technology that disrupts copyright does so because it simplifies and cheapens creation, reproduction, and distribution. The existing copyright businesses exploit inefficiencies in the old production, reproduction, and distribution system, and they'll be weakened by a new technology. But technology always gives us more art with a wider reach. That's what tech is for. Tech gives us bigger pies that more artists can get a bite out of. That's been tacitly acknowledged at every stage of the copy fight since the piano roll. When copyright and technology collide, it's copyright that changes. Which means that today's copyright, the thing that DRM nominally props up, did not come down off a mountain on two stone tablets. It was created in living memory to accommodate the technological reality created by the inventors of the previous generation. To abandon invention now robs tomorrow's artists of the new businesses and new reach and new audiences that the internet and the PC can give them. 5. DRM is a bad business move for Microsoft. When Sony brought out the VCR, it made a record player that could play Hollywood's records, even if Hollywood didn't like the idea. The industries that grew up on the back of the VCR, movie rentals, home taping, camcorders, even bar mitzvah videographers, made billions for Sony and its cohort. That was good business. Even if Sony lost the Betamax VHS format wars, the money on the World with VCRs table was enough to make up for it. But then Sony acquired a relatively tiny entertainment company, and it started to massively screw up. When MP3 rolled around and Sony's Walkman customers were clamoring for a solid-state MP3 player, Sony let its music business unit run its show. Instead of making a high-capacity MP3 Walkman, Sony shipped its music clips, low-capacity devices that played brain-damaged DRM formats like Reel and OpenMG. They spent good money engineering features into these devices that kept their customers from freely moving their music back and forth between their devices. Customers stayed away in droves. Today, Sony is dead in the water when it comes to Walkman. The market leaders are pokey Singaporean outfits like Creative Labs, the kind of company that Sony used to crush like a bug back before it got borged by its entertainment unit, and PC companies like Apple. That's because Sony shipped a product that there was no market demand for. No Sony customer woke up one morning and said, "Damn, I wish Sony would devote some expensive engineering effort in order that I might do less with my music." Presented with an alternative, Sony's customers enthusiastically jumped ship. The same happened to a lot of people I know who used to rip their CDs to WMA. You guys sold them software that produced smaller, better-sounding rips than the MP3 rippers, but you also fixed it so that the songs you ripped were device-locked to their PCs. What this meant is that when they backed up their music to another hard drive and reinstalled their OS, something that the spyware and malware wars have made more common than ever, they discovered that after they restored their music, they could no longer play it. The player saw the new OS as a different machine and locked them out of their own music. There is no market demand for this feature. None of your customers want you to make expensive modifications to your products that makes backing up and restoring even harder, And there is no moment when your customers will be less forgiving than the moment that they are recovering from catastrophic technology failures. I speak from experience. Because I buy a new PowerBook every 10 months, and because I always order the new models the day they're announced, I get a lot of lemons from Apple. That means that I hit Apple's 3 iTunes authorized computers limit pretty early on and found myself unable to play the hundreds of dollars worth of iTunes songs I'd bought because one of my authorized machines was a lemon that Apple had broken up for parts, one was in the shop getting fixed by Apple, and one was my mom's computer 3,000 miles away in Toronto. If I had been a less good customer for Apple's hardware, I would have been fine. If I had been a less enthusiastic evangelist for Apple's products, if I hadn't shown my mom how iTunes Music Store worked, I would have been fine. If I hadn't bought so much iTunes music that burning it to CD and re-ripping it and re-keying all my metadata was too daunting a task to consider, I would have been fine. As it was, Apple rewarded my trust, evangelism, and out-of-control spending by treating me like a crook and locking me out of my own music at a time when my PowerBook was in the shop, i.e., at a time when I was hardly disposed to feel charitable to Apple. A note here, I ended up switching to Linux within a couple of years. I'm an edge case here, but I'm a leading edge case. If Apple succeeds in its business plans, it will only be a matter of time until even average customers have upgraded enough hardware and bought enough music to end up where I am. Do you know what I would totally buy? A record player that let me play everyone's records. Right now, the closest I can come to that is an open source app called VLC, but it's clunky and buggy, and it didn't come pre-installed on my computer. Another note here, VLC is now very good, and it comes pre-installed on Linux. Sony didn't make a Betamax that only played the movies that Hollywood was willing to permit. Hollywood asked them to do it. They proposed an early analog broadcast flag that VCRs could hunt for and respond to by disabling recording. Sony ignored them, and they made the product that they thought their customers wanted. I'm a Microsoft customer. Like millions of other Microsoft customers, I want a player that plays anything I throw at it, and I think that you are just the company to give it to me. Yes, this would violate copyright law as it stands, but Microsoft has been making tools of piracy that change copyright law for decades now. Outlook, Exchange, and MSN are tools that abet widespread digital infringement. More significantly, IIS and your caching proxies all make and serve copies of documents without their author's consent, something that, if it is legal today, is only legal because companies like Microsoft went ahead and did it and dared lawmakers to prosecute. Microsoft stood up for its customers and for progress and won so decisively that most people never even realized there was a fight. Do it again. This is a company that looks the world's roughest, toughest antitrust regulators in the eye and laughs. Compared to the antitrust people, copyright lawmakers are panty wastes. You can take them with your arm behind your back. This is especially ironic given today's antitrust stuff. Just noting that for the record here. In Siva Vaidyanathan's book, The Anarchist in the Library, he talks about why the studios are so blind to their customers' desires. It's because people like you and me spent the 80s and the 90s telling them bad science fiction stories about impossible DRM technology that would let them charge a small sum of money every time someone looked at a movie. Want to fast forward? That feature costs another penny. Pausing is 2 cents an hour. The mute button will cost you a quarter. When Mako Analysis issued their report last month advising phone companies to stop supporting Symbian phones, they were just writing the latest installment in this story. Mako says that phones like my P900, which can play MP3s as ringtones, are bad for the cell phone economy because it'll put the extortionate ringtone sellers out of business. What Mako is saying is that just because you bought the CD doesn't mean that you should expect to have the ability to listen to it on your MP3 player, and just because it plays on your MP3 player is no reason to expect that it runs as a ringtone. I wonder how they feel about alarm clocks that will pay a CD to wake you up in the morning. Is that strangling a nascent alarm tone market? The phone company's customers want Symbian phones, and for now at least, the phone companies understand that if they don't sell them, someone else will. The market opportunity for a truly capable device is enormous. There's a company out there charging $27,000 for a DVD jukebox? Go out and eat their lunch! Steve Jobs isn't going to do it. He's off at the D conference telling studio execs not to release high-def movies until they're sure no one will make a high-def DVD burner that works with a PC. Maybe they won't buy into his BS, but they're also not much interested in what you have to sell. At the Broadcast Protection Discussion Group meetings where the broadcast flag was hammered out, the studio's position was, we'll take anyone's DRM except Microsoft's and Philips. When I met with UK broadcast wonks at the European version of the broadcast flag underway at the Digital Video Broadcasters Forum, they told me, well, it's different in Europe. Mostly, they're worried that some American company like Microsoft will get their claws into European television. American film studios didn't want the Japanese electronics companies to make a piece of the movie pie, so they fought the VCR. Today, everyone who makes movies agrees that they don't want to let you guys get between them and their customers. Sony didn't get permission. Neither should you. Go build the record player that can play everyone's records. Because if you don't do it, someone else will. All right. Well, that's the reading. Boy, that was fun. Symbian phones, huh? All right, Corey of 2004. Go get them. Well, that was something. I can't even remember if I'm going to be around next week. I guess I will be. I'll be fresh back from the Locus Awards. Maybe I'll record something for you then. Have a good week. Talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, Ryneck Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.